Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Equities continue their grind higher with the S&P 500 setting new all-time highs every day last week. The natural questions after a week like that are whether this grind can continue and what could derail it. This week there is an FOMC meeting that will decide on rate cuts, the start of July data with the payrolls report coming out on Friday, and nearly 40% of the S&P 500 reporting Q2 earnings. So much for the summer slowdown, Jason. With that, joining me here in studio on this Monday morning, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Nice to be back at the table with you, Jason. Good morning, and looking forward to our conversation.
Good morning. Happy Monday. It's good to be here in the air-conditioned office.
Definitely.
You mentioned we have a lot to cover, so I know some people listen to podcasts at 1.5 speed. Maybe I'll just try and talk at 1.5 speed.
We'll do our best to cram this in 15 yes. minutes, no promises. Yeah. Though before we get into this week, which I alluded to a lot happening over the next 5 days or so, let's back up a bit because we did receive some news trade-related over the weekend. President Trump did announce a trade deal with the European Union yesterday on Sunday, which followed a deal with Japan earlier in the week. So, Jason, what do these deals say about the outlook for tariffs from this point forward?
Well, let's just start with the deal with the EU. It set sort of a rate of 15%. This is up from sort of the 10% universal tariff imposed back in, on April 2nd. The reciprocal tariffs on a country-by-country basis were delayed. Mm-hmm. There was threats from President Trump to go to 30%. So depending on how you want to look at it, this is glass half full, glass half empty. But like, at least there is some kind of clarity on what this actually entails. This follows on, as you mentioned, a deal, like at least a framework deal with Japan. Mm-hmm. Other countries have been coming into place. And as we record this on Monday morning, there are reports that the kind of agreement that the U.S. and China had on trade, that will be extended for another 90 days. So the concern a few weeks ago, like on when the reciprocal tariff reprieve would end, July 9th, that was extended to August 1st. Now, as August 1st is only a few days away, it looks like there's, we're kind of coming to a place where that's not going to be a major risk event.
Mm-hmm.
The 15% that was agreed to with the EU is interesting because that is kind of the effective tariff rate in all imports into the U.S. that we think is sort of will kind of converge to that, give or take a little bit. So it's kind of further reinforces that particular view. And the range around of possible outcomes just kind of gets narrower and narrower as we kind of get these actual numbers in place. So where do we go from here? So we have deals potentially with the EU, Japan, China has a separate track. The two major trading partners that there isn't really a deal with right now is Canada and Mexico. So there is certainly time for something to happen. But also, while there's higher tariffs on those countries, a good percentage of their imports into the U.S. are exempt from the USMCA deal. Reciprocal tariffs do matter, but that's not kind of a different animal given that deal. So that is still something to watch. It could be, again, a bit of a speed bump. The details still matter. All these announcements are kind of general level, high level, on right. time cases, press conference tweets. So for the EU deal, they've committed to buying $750 billion of U.S. energy, invest an incremental $600 billion in the U.S., and also purchase, in quotes, vast amounts of U.S. military equipment. Like, what's the enforcement mechanism? Who's right. going to buy it? What's the numbers? So the details will still matter, and they could create hiccups. Sectoral tariffs on pharma, semis, maybe autos, mm-hmm. those could still be coming in the pipeline later that alter these things. July 31st, the Court of Appeals will hear a testimony regarding the IEEPA, or the use of IEEPA, the Emergency Act, for President Trump to impose these 10 or 15% tariffs. That could ultimately go to the Supreme Court, and the court could rule that these are actually not allowed under law. So again, there's still some speed bumps ahead. For the markets, I think this is starting to become kind of old news. People are kind of moving on. They kind of have a sense of where things are headed. Yes, there'll be headline noise, but I think that's mm-hmm. right or wrong, that's the way the market's treating this right now.
So that covers where we stand on trade and a lot still to be figured out. Though if we turn to this week, a lot happening, perhaps let's begin with the Fed. The big focus this week will be on the FOMC meeting. Beginning tomorrow, we will receive the rate decision on Wednesday. And we also have the July payrolls report coming out on Friday. Jason, what do you expect and what could the outcomes mean for the markets?
Well, right now, it's very unlikely the Fed will cut rates. The market implied probability is 2.5% of a 25 basis point cut this week. Given the data that's come out, you know, you could say like the Fed doesn't need to be in a rush and they likely won't cut. And certainly nothing from Powell has indicated that that's going to happen. We are in the blackout period right now. So if there's no cut, the focus will then be very much on the statement, but also most specifically on the press conference that Powell has afterwards. Like he'll be asked various questions. There is a decent chance that there'll be dissenters, meaning some FOMC members will choose to vote for a cut. Chris Waller and Michelle Bowman have actually been out there, you know, pretty clearly stating we think that we're ready to cut. So there definitely could be some dissent, but overall the committee would still err on the side of not cutting. Powell likely would be asked about that, whether September they didn't cut now, but in September it's going to happen then. He will never be committal. He said already that, you know, every meeting is effectively live and based on the discussion, debate, assessment of the data. He would then point out that for September meeting, that they'll have 2 more months of inflation data and jobs data by the time they have that. So more information, so hard to pre-commit to anything now. If the Powell does want to guide towards a cut in September, he will likely wait until the Jackson Hole, you know, Fed symposium. Later in August. That's been used in the past to kind of guide what will happen later on. They will have essentially the full set of July data at that point in time. And if he wants to signal the markets, that's the direction mm-hmm. of travel. That would be the key thing to look for. I wouldn't expect anything kind of this week. So it can end up ultimately being sort of uneventful from a market's perspective. For the Fed, you may get some more tweets complaining about you did not cut rates, more complaints. But I think, you know, the path overall, I think, for monetary policy is clear. We expect a September cut as our baseline. Market pricing is at 66%, so 2/3 chance. So very much kind of data dependent. And ultimately, our view is that the Fed will cut 100 basis points by Q1, starting with the September cut. Turning to the jobs data. That's probably the bigger, you know, kind of source of maybe risk or uncertainty. The Bloomberg consensus among economist forecasters is about 110,000. For the last 3 months, the average monthly job gain is 149,000. There's some quirks in the data, you know, for seasonal reasons. But like, let's say 100,000 plus is kind of what's consensus. The general trend is for job growth to kind of slow. I mean, that's just some of it's the structural factors of the labor market. The unemployment rate, you know, is expected to be 4.2%. And again, rounding errors, it could be, you know, give or take a little bit mm-hmm. around that. But so the question really is, what would surprise the markets? You know, anything that is a really weak number, and by weak, I mean like kind of less than 50,000, I think that's what we're going to get the market scared. For context, a year ago, when we got the July 2024 jobs number in early August, the initial estimate was 11,000, far below expectations. It fueled these concerns about the economy suddenly slowing sharply. Equity sold off, you know, kind of pulled forward rate cut expectations. So I think it would take some number like that to suddenly get investors to come out after the Fed didn't cut to think, oh, you know, the Fed is behind the curve. Things are really kind of slowing down. If it's a really strong number, then you probably take September off the table. And it's a bit of maybe, you know, some good news could be bad news for the markets because it sort of delays further when the Fed could cut. You know, lots of focus, but in some ways these events could end up being relatively, you know, low volatility events for the markets.
Let's switch gears a bit, talk about earnings. We do have a busy week ahead of us with results, though that's coming after another busy week for earnings. So based on what we've seen thus far, Jason, what are some key takeaways for Q2 earnings results?
Well, we've had about 40% of the S&P 500 market cap report so far, and the results are solid. You know, if you look at based on what percentage of companies are beating expectations for earnings, revenue, or both, the percentages are above kind of the long-term averages, you know, relative at this point in this kind of the earnings season. So again, like kind of good in that regards. Coming into the earnings season, the earnings for Q2 were expected to grow about 4.2% year over year. This is, again, based on bottoms-up analyst expectations. Given what we've had thus far, it's more like about 6%. So, again, the results, you know, solid overall. Guidance has been solid. It's something we talked about, you know, last week in terms of guiding forward. It wasn't sort of taking things down. It was holding steady. The level of optimism, or at least pessimism, is certainly diminished as we get sort of perhaps more clarity on the state of tariffs, passing the one big beautiful bill, you know, compared to where we were a few months ago. So, you know, a solid report overall. This week, 40% of the S&P market cap will report. The big focus will be on four, the Mag 7, which is Apple, Amazon, Meta, and Microsoft. A lot of focus will be on their CapEx spend in addition to their numbers. One of the key data points from last week is Google reported, or Alphabet reported. Their numbers were good, but I think what was, you know, the key thing is they upgraded their CapEx investment for AI infrastructure by $10 billion. I think it's now, either 85 billion or, or went from 85 to 95 billion. So further ramping up, and this kind of fuels the kind of AI theme, the AI trade in the marketplace, the tech trade. So I think that's kind of the key focus this week is the numbers overall, but that story in particular, because there's a lot of momentum in that direction.
So Jason, at this point, we focused on developments happening last week and this week, though I want to spend a few moments highlighting your latest blog. That title is The Great Risk Transfer, and within you argue that the relative market calm masks a big structural risk shift. So what do you mean by this, Jason?
So, you know, we talk a lot about the tactical. Let's sometimes, especially when things are kind of quiet, a chance to maybe kind of step back and look at big picture where things are going. So the idea is that, you know, in the first half of this decade, there was a significant shift in sort of risk-bearing responsibility from the private sector to the public sector. That was the first half of this decade. It's already some of those risks, ownership responsibilities was already shifting back to the private sector. But even more than that, more risks are going to likely be borne by the private sector for the rest of this decade, likely beyond. What do I mean by this? Well, think about what happened during 2020, 21, even 22 during the pandemic. Enormous economic shock. People could lose their jobs, lose their businesses. What happened? We had an extraordinary policy response where the federal government effectively borrowed $3, $4, $5 trillion and transferred it to households through stimulus checks, enhanced unemployment benefits, the Paycheck Protection Program, other sort of, you know, programs to support the private sector. The Fed cut rates at zero, did all sorts of programs to support, you know, the, you know, financial markets, kept rates at zero into early 2022, even as inflation, you know, rose. So tremendous policy support to try and essentially provide insurance to the private sector, to individuals against this economic shock. That sort of stimulus, those policy measures, a bit by bit of weaned away. The Fed is, you know, has raised rates to kind of a restrictive territory. All the stimulus stuff has kind of gone away. So all that sort of risk bearing, you know, was taken on by the government. That's kind of, you know, easing. But my suggestion is that not only are we kind of go back to maybe a pre-pandemic level of risk sharing between the private sector and the public sector, there's actually more risks will be borne by kind of the private sector for different reasons, for policy choices, policy constraints, economic developments. And the note kind of touches on four broad categories, which I'll highlight, you know, very quickly. You know, one is that, you know, some of the current policy, I think, just ultimately kind of provides less protection for the private sector versus where we were in the years pre-pandemic. The Fed has policy rates restrictive as opposed to loose or even just sort of neutral. The one big beautiful bill, you know, there's, you know, basically just extends the existing tax cuts. There's some incremental tax cuts. At the same time, the CBO estimates that by 2034, upwards of, I think, you know, 8 or 10 billion or 10 million people will lose Medicare coverage. So again, you know, they'll be kind of left without that insurance. There's a large amount of money, $145 billion, that goes towards immigration and border protection. That's going to at least increase deportations. There are 8 million, roughly, migrants and undocumented workers in the U.S. Leaving aside the politics and the merits of that, they are a lot of men in the workforce. And now if you're worried about showing up for work because of this, you're less likely to work, less likely to maybe be out consuming, doing economic activities that have a sort of negative implications for the economy. So that's one example. Another is just the ability for policymakers, fiscal monetary policy, to provide support going forward is going to be more constrained. Simple number, the deficit to GDP this year at the federal level is going to be 6.2%, according to the CBO. Drops a little bit to like a little over 5% next couple of years, but basically for the from like 29 to 2035, 6%. This is at a time when employment is kind of essentially we're at full employment, unemployment low 4%. In the last 50 plus years, anytime unemployment has been below 5%, by and large, you've had a deficit less than 3%. All this means there's not a lot of dry powder on the fiscal front that if there's a recession, can you provide stimulus without taking deficits and sort of, you know, much higher and much bigger? Same thing, inflation is still elevated. Can the Fed cut as much if they're worried about inflation? So policy is a little more constrained. There's choices that are being made that are by policymakers, politicians in the U.S. globally, for geopolitical reasons, for political reasons, things of that sort, that are actually exacerbating economic risks. Tariff uncertainty, where is that going to play out? Not having formal deals, but opposed to just essentially tweets announcing reactions that could be changed, that creates sort of uncertainty. Great power competition between the U.S. and China often means that decisions can be made for geopolitical reasons, security reasons, not economic reasons. So again, adding uncertainty rather than reducing it. Telling the Fed to cut rates, questioning Fed independence, creates a risk of, well, perhaps you just have financial repression that keeps rates low, but it means elevated inflation and inflation volatility. And the final thing is AI. We all know it's going to have big implications on the economy and the labor force. people might be worried about their job, their career path. We're already seeing evidence for certainly for younger people, like, has the unemployment rate for recent college grads gone up because of AI? Perhaps. Are people choosing career paths because they realize I could be disruptive? Yes. So there's examples where AI will have an impact, and it's alter, you know, what they'll do. It poses risks to individuals. There's no real policies right now to deal with it. All these things suggest kind of more risks for the private sector.
So some very interesting considerations, perhaps not front and center at the moment, though they do pose some notable ramifications perhaps down the pike. So thank you, Jason, for highlighting those. I will encourage our listeners to read the blog, The Great Risk Transfer, to read further into these points made today by Jason. Before we close out this morning, Jason, I do want to spend a few moments here on allocation recommendations. This coincides with the latest CIO House View update, which was published last week. So can you speak a bit, Jason, to the notable changes in views and recommendations at this time?
Well, the title of the House View letter was quiet, too quiet. You mentioned earlier that every day last week, the S&P 500 hit an all-time high. The VIX Volatility Index was down below 15 on Friday. Relatively quiet, complacent, maybe too complacent markets. They're pricing in a lot of good news. And the concern that we have is that, well, medium term, the next 12 months, the fundamentals we think will still be supportive for risk assets, for equities to go higher. And the near term, they're kind of vulnerable to any sort of disappointment, whether it's a weak job print, inflation data that runs a little bit hotter. We start to see the negative impact on the economy of tariffs that the markets have kind of moved on from. Well, now we might actually just kind of see that materialize. AI, CapEx investment may not be what investors are expecting. So a bunch of things that could lead to some volatility. So just think about that in terms of like preparing for volatility. If you have capital allocated to where we have the most conviction right now are areas that are tied to kind of longer term themes, like these kind of these transformational opportunities, like AI. This seems to be kind of somewhat less sensitive to the macro conditions, and that's kind of moving, you know, forward. You know, the numbers I mentioned regarding Google's CapEx, consistent with that. On fixed income, you know, yields have come down a little bit. Spreads have tightened quite a bit, you know, kind of in line with equities going higher. So again, sort of, you know, a message is to buy quality bonds. Don't take a lot of, you know, credit risk. Don't take a lot of duration risk in terms of interest rates potentially kind of rising higher at this time. So sort of, you know, more of this, you know, a lot of this kind of same message we've been saying, but in some way, just in particular, be conscious of the fact that it's been relatively calm. It's been a nice summer so far, but this is often a backdrop, especially as we go into the fall, when we know September and October historically are choppy, you know, challenging periods, ultimately kind of come better at year end, but that's just an environment we may be headed to.
Well, Jason, thank you for keeping our listeners, our clients informed on CIO's latest thinking when it comes to positioning and for previewing for us what will be a busy few days ahead. We will have a lot to talk about when we reconvene for our next conversation next Monday morning, though I wish you a great week ahead, Jason. Thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.